The Idiot, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1. Chapter 1. At 9 o'clock in the morning, towards the end of November, the Warsaw train was approaching Petersburg at full speed. It was thawing, and so damp and foggy that it was difficult to distinguish anything 10 paces from the line to right or left of the carriage windows. Some of the passengers were returning from abroad, but the third-class compartments were most crowded, chiefly with people of humble rank, who had come a shorter distance on business. All, of course, were tired and shivering. Their eyes were heavy after the night's journey, and all their faces were pale and yellow to match the fog. In one of the third-class carriages, 2 passengers had, from early dawn, been sitting facing one another by the window. Both were young men, not very well dressed, and travelling with little luggage. Both were of rather striking appearance, and both showed a desire to enter into conversation. If they had both known what was remarkable in one another at that moment, they would have been surprised at the chance which had so strangely brought them opposite one another in a third-class carriage of the Warsaw train. One of them was a short man, about 27, with almost black curly hair and small, grey, fiery eyes. He had a broad and flat nose and high cheekbones. His thin lips were continually curved in an insolent, mocking, and even malicious smile. But the high and well-shaped forehead redeemed the ignoble lines of the lower part of the face. What was particularly striking about the young man's face was its death-like pallor, which gave him a look of exhaustion in spite of his sturdy figure, and at the same time an almost painfully passionate expression, out of keeping with his coarse and insolent smile and the hard and conceited look in his eyes. He was warmly dressed in a full black sheepskin-lined overcoat, and had not felt the cold at night, while his shivering neighbour had been exposed to the chill and damp of a Russian November night, for which he was evidently unprepared. He had a fairly thick and full cloak with a big hood, such as is often used in winter by travellers abroad in Switzerland or the north of Italy, who are not, of course, proposing such a journey as that from Eitkunen to Petersburg. But what was quite suitable and satisfactory in Italy turned out not quite sufficient for Russia. The owner of the cloak was a young man, also 26 or 27 years old, above the average in height, with very fair thick hair, with sunken cheeks and a thin, pointed, almost white beard. His eyes were large, blue, and dreamy. There was something gentle, though heavy-looking, in their expression, something of that strange look from which some people can recognise at the first glance a victim of epilepsy. Yet the young man's face was pleasing, thin and clean-cut, though colourless, and at this moment blue with cold. He carried a little bundle tied up in an old faded silk handkerchief, apparently containing all his belongings. He wore thick-soled shoes and gaiters, all in the foreign style. His dark-haired neighbour in the sheepskin observed all this, partly from having nothing to do, and at last, with an indelicate smile, in which satisfaction at the misfortunes of others is sometimes so unceremoniously and casually expressed, he asked, "Chilly?" And he twitched his shoulders. "Very," answered his neighbour with extraordinary readiness. "And to think it's thawing, too. What if it were freezing? I didn't expect it to be so cold at home. I've got out of the way of it." "From abroad, eh?" "Yes, from Switzerland." "Phew! You don't say so," the dark-haired man whistled and laughed. They fell into talk. The readiness of the fair young man in the Swiss cloak to answer all his companion's inquiries was remarkable. He betrayed no suspicion of the extreme impertinence of some of his misplaced and idle questions. He told him he had been a long while, over 4 years, away from Russia, that he had been sent abroad for his health on account of a strange nervous disease, something of the nature of epilepsy or St. Vitus's dance, attacks of twitching and trembling. The dark man smiled several times as he listened and laughed, especially when, in answer to his inquiry, "Well, have they cured you?" his companion answered, "No, they haven't." "Ha! You must have wasted a lot of money over it. And we believe in them over here," the dark man observed sarcastically. "Perfectly true," interposed a badly dressed, heavily built man of about 40, with a red nose and pimpled face sitting beside them. He seemed to be some sort of petty official, with the typical failings of his class. "Perfectly true. They only absorb all the resources of Russia for nothing."
"Oh, you are quite mistaken in my case," the patient from Switzerland replied in a gentle and conciliatory voice. "I can't dispute your opinion, of course, because I don't know all about it. But my doctor shared his last penny with me for the journey here, and he's been keeping me for nearly 2 years at his expense."
"Why? Had you no one to pay for you?" asked the dark man.
"No. Mr. Pavlishev, who used to pay for me there, died 2 years ago. I've written since to Petersburg, to Madame Panchin, a distant relation of mine, but I've had no answer. So I've come..."
"Where are you going, then?"
"You mean, where am I going to stay? I really don't know yet. Somewhere..."
"You've not made up your mind yet?"
And both his listeners laughed again.
"And I shouldn't wonder if that bundle is all you've got in the world," queried the dark man. "I wouldn't mind betting it is," chimed in the red-nosed official with a gleeful air. "And there is nothing else in the luggage van, though poverty is no vice, one must admit."
It appeared that this was the case. The fair-haired young man acknowledged it at once with peculiar readiness.
"Your bundle has some value anyway,"
the petty official went on, when they had laughed to their heart's content. Strange to say, the owner of the bundle began to laugh too, looking at them, and that increased their mirth.
"And though one may safely bet there is no gold in it, neither French, German, nor Dutch, one may be sure of that, if only from the gaiters you have got on over your foreign shoes. Yet if you can add to your bundle a relation, such as Madame Epanchin, the general's lady, the bundle acquires a very different value. That is, if Madame Epanchin really is related to you, and you are not labouring under a delusion, a mistake that often happens, through excess of imagination."
"Ah, you've guessed right again," the fair young man assented. "It really is almost a mistake. That's to say, she is almost no relation. So much so that I really was not at all surprised at getting no answer. It was what I expected."
"You simply wasted the money for the stamps! Anyway, you are straightforward and simple-hearted, and that's to your credit." "I know General Epanchin, for he is a man everyone knows. And I used to know Mr. Pavlishev, too, who paid your expenses in Switzerland. That is, if it was Nikolai Andreevich Pavlishev, for there were two of them, cousins. The other lives in the Crimea. The late Nikolai Andreevich was a worthy man and well-connected, and he'd 4,000 serfs in his day."
"That's right. Nikolai Andreevich was his name."
And as he answered, the young man looked intently and searchingly at the omniscient gentleman. Such omniscient gentlemen are to be found pretty often in a certain stratum of society. They know everything. All the restless curiosity and faculties of their mind are irresistibly bent in one direction, no doubt from lack of more important ideas and interests in life, as the critic of today would explain. But the words, "they know everything," must be taken in a rather limited sense. In what department so-and-so serves? Who are his friends? What his income is? Where he was governor? Who his wife is, and what dowry she brought him? Who are his first cousins, and who are his second cousins, and everything of that sort? For the most part, these omniscient gentlemen are out at elbow, and receive a salary of 17 rubles a month. The people of whose lives they know every detail would be at a loss to imagine their motives. Yet many of them get positive consolation out of this knowledge, which amounts to a complete science, and derive from it self-respect and their highest spiritual gratification. And indeed, it is a fascinating science. I have seen learned men, literary men, poets, politicians, who sought and found in that science their loftiest comfort and their ultimate goal, and have indeed made their career only by means of it. During this part of the conversation, the dark young man had been yawning and looking aimlessly out of the window, impatiently expecting the end of the journey. He was preoccupied, extremely so, in fact, almost agitated. His behaviour, indeed, was somewhat strange. Sometimes he seemed to be listening without hearing, and looking without seeing. He would laugh sometimes, not knowing or forgetting what he was laughing at.
"Excuse me, whom have I the honour..."
the pimply gentleman said suddenly, addressing the fair young man with the bundle.
"Prince Lev Nikolaevich Mushkin is my name," the latter replied, with prompt and unhesitating readiness.
"Prince Mushkin? Lev Nikolaevich? I don't know it. I don't believe I've ever heard it," the official responded thoughtfully. "I don't mean the surname, it's an historical name. It's to be found in Karamazin's history, and with good reason. I mean you personally. And indeed, there are no Prince Mushkins to be met anywhere. One never hears of them."
"I should think not," Mushkin answered at once. "There are no Prince Mushkins now except me. I believe I am the last of them. And as for our fathers and grandfathers, some of them were no more than peasant proprietors. My father was a sub-lieutenant in the army, yet General Epanchin's wife was somehow Princess Mushkin. She was the last of her lot, too."
"The last of her lot! How funnily you put it," chuckled the official.
The dark man grinned, too. Mushkin was rather surprised that he had perpetrated a joke, and indeed, it was a feeble one.
"Believe me, I said it without thinking,"
he explained at last, wondering.
To be sure you did," the official assented good-humouredly. "And have you been studying, too, with the professor out there, Prince?"
asked the dark man suddenly.
"Yes, I have."
"But I've never studied anything."
"Well, I only did a little, you know," added Mushkin, almost apologetically. "I couldn't be taught systematically because of my illness."
"Do you know the Rogozhins?"
the dark man asked quickly.
"No, I don't know them at all. I know very few people in Russia. Are you a Rogozhin?"
"Yes, my name is Rogozhin, Parfian." "Parfian? One of those Rogozhins?"
the official began with increased gravity.
"Yes, one of those. One of the same,"
the dark man interrupted quickly, with uncivil impatience. He had not once addressed the pimply gentleman, indeed, but from the beginning had spoken only to Mushkin.
"But how is that?"
The official was petrified with amazement, and his eyes seemed almost starting out of his head. His whole face immediately assumed an expression of reverence and civility, almost of awe.
"Related to the Semyon Parfenovich Rogozhin, who died a month ago and left a fortune of 2.5 million rubles?
"And how do you know he left 2.5 millions?
The dark man interrupted, not deigning even now to glance towards the official.
"Look at him,"
he winked to Mushkin, indicating him.
"What do they gain by cringing upon one at once? But it's true that my father has been dead a month, and here I am, coming home from Pskov, almost without boots to my feet. My brother, the rascal, and my mother haven't sent me a penny, nor a word, nothing, as if I were a dog. I've been lying ill with fever at Pskov for the last month.
And now you are coming in for a tidy million, at the lowest reckoning. Oh, Lord!"
the official flung up his hands.
"What is it to him? Tell me that,"
said Rogozhin, nodding irritably and angrily towards him again.
"Why, I'm not going to give you a farthing of it. You may stand on your head before me, if you like."
"I will, I will.
You see, but I won't give you anything. I won't, if you dance for a whole week." "Well, don't. Why should you? Don't. But I shall dance. I shall leave my wife and little children and dance before you. I must do homage. I must."
"Hang you!"
the dark man spat.
5 weeks ago, like you, with nothing but a bundle," he said, addressing the prince. "I ran away from my father to my aunt's at Pskov, and there I fell ill, and he died while I was away. He kicked the bucket. Eternal memory to the deceased, but he almost killed me.
Would you believe it, prince? Yes, by God. If I hadn't run away then, he would have killed me on the spot."
"Did you make him very angry?"
asked the prince, looking with special interest at the millionaire in the sheepskin. But though there may have been something remarkable in the million and in coming into an inheritance, Mushkin was surprised and interested at something else as well. And Rogozhin himself, for some reason, talked readily to the prince, though indeed his need of conversation seemed rather physical than mental, arising more from preoccupation than frankness, from agitation and excitement, for the sake of looking at someone and exercising his tongue. He seemed to be still ill, or at least feverish. As for the petty official, he was simply hanging on Rogozhin, hardly daring to breathe and catching at each word as though he hoped to find a diamond.
"Angry he certainly was, and perhaps with reason," answered Rogozhin. "But it was my brother's doing more than anything. My mother I can't blame.
She's an old woman, spent her time reading the lives of the saints, sitting with old women. And what Brother Simeon says is law. And why didn't he let me know in time, I understand it. It's true, I was unconscious at the time. They say a telegram was sent too, but it was sent to my aunt. And she has been a widow for 30 years, and she spends her time with crazy pilgrims from morning till night. She's not a nun, exactly, but something worse. She was frightened by the telegram, and took it to the police station without opening it, and there it lies to this day. Only Vasily Vasilich Konyov was the saving of me. He wrote me all about it. At night, my brother cut off the solid gold tassels from the brocaded pall on my father's coffin. "Think what a lot of money they are worth," said he. "For that alone, he can be sent to Siberia, if I like, for its sacrilege. Hey there, you, scarecrow," he turned to the official. "Is that the law? Is it sacrilege?"
"It is sacrilege, it is," the latter assented at once.
"Is it a matter of Siberia?"
"Siberia, to be sure. Siberia at once."
"They think I'm still ill," Rogozhin went on to Mushkin. "But without a word to anyone, I got into the carriage, ill as I was, and I am on my way home. You'll have to open the door to me, Brother Semyon Semyonovich." "He turned my father against me, I know. But it's true, I did anger my father over Nastasia Philipovna. That was my own doing. I was in fault there."
"Oh, over Nastasia Philipovna,"
the official pronounced with civility, seeming to deliberate.
"Why, you don't know her!"
Rogozhin shouted impatiently.
"Yes, I do,"
answered the man triumphantly.
"Upon my word, but there are lots of Nastasia Philipovnas. And what an insolent brute you are, let me tell you."
"I knew some brute like this would hang on to me at once," he continued to Mushkin.
"But perhaps I do know,"
said the official, fidgeting.
"Lebedev knows. You are pleased to reproach me, Your Excellency. But what if I prove it? Yes, I mean that very Nastasia Philipovna, on account of whom your parent tried to give you a lesson with his stick. Nastasia Philipovna's name is Barashkov, and she's a lady, so to speak, of high position, and even a princess in her own way, and she is connected with a man called Totsky, Afanasy Ivanovich, with him and no one else, a man of property and great fortune, a member of companies and societies, and he's great friends with General Epanchin on that account."
"Aha! Uh-huh. So that's it, is it?"
Rogozhin was genuinely surprised at last.
"Oh, hang it. He actually does know. He knows everything. Lebedev knows everything. I went about with young Alexandre Lohachev for 2 months, Your Excellency, and it was after his father's death, too, and I know my way about, so to say, so that he couldn't stir a step without Lebedev. Now he is in the debtor's prison. But then I had every opportunity to know Armand Sonkorolai, and Princess Patsky, and Nastasia Philipovna, and much else besides."
"Nastasia Philipovna? Why, did Lohachev—"
Rogozhin looked angrily at him. His lips positively twitched and turned white.
"Not at all. Not at all. Not in the least,"
the official assured him with nervous haste.
"Lohachev couldn't get at her for any money. No, she is not an Armance. She has nobody but Totsky, and of an evening she sits in her own box at the Grand or the French Theatre. The officers may talk a lot about her, but even they can say nothing against her. That's the famous Nastasia Philipovna, they say. And that's all. But nothing further, for there is nothing."
"That's all true," Rogozhin confirmed, frowning gloomily. "Zelyovshev said so at the time. I was running across the Nevsky Prince in my father's 3-year-old coat, and she came out of her shop and got into her carriage. I was all aflame in an instant. I met Zelyovshev. He is quite another sort. Got up like a hairdresser's assistant, with an eyeglass in his eye, while at my father's house we wear tarred boots and are kept on Lenten soup. 'She's no match for you, my boy,' he said. 'She is a princess. Her name is Nastasia Philipovna Barashkov, and she is living with Totsky, and Totsky doesn't know how to get rid of her, for he's just reached the proper time of life, 55, so that he wants to marry the greatest beauty in Petersburg. Then he told me that I could see Nastasia Philipovna that day at the Grand Theatre, at the ballet. She'd be in her box in the baignoire. As for going to the ballet, if anyone at home had tried that on, Father would have settled it. He would have killed one. But I did slip in for an hour, though, and saw Nastasia Philipovna again. I didn't sleep all that night. Next morning, my late father gave me 2 5% bonds for 5,000 rubles each. Go and sell them, he said, and take 7,500 to Andreev's office and pay the account and bring back what's left of the 10,000 straight to me. I shall wait for you. I cashed the bonds, took the money, but I didn't go to Andreev's. I went straight to the English shop and picked out a pair of earrings with a diamond nearly as big as a nut in each of them. I gave the whole 10,000 for it and left owing 400. I gave them my name and they trusted me. I went with the earrings to Zolyovshev. I told him and said, let us go to Nastasia Filipovna's brother. We set off. I don't know and can't remember what was under my feet, what was before me or about me. We went straight into her drawing room. She came into us herself. I didn't tell at the time who I was, but Zolyovshev said, this is from Parfyon Ragozhin, in memory of his meeting you yesterday. Graciously accept it. She opened it, looked and smiled. Thank your friend, Mr. Ragozhin, for his kind attention, and she bowed and went out. Well, why didn't I die on the spot? I went to her because I thought I shouldn't come back alive, and what mortified me most of all was that that beast Zolyovshev took it all to himself. I am short and badly dressed, and I stood without a word staring at her because I was ashamed. And he's in the height of fashion, curled and pomaded, rosy and in a check tie. He was all bows and graces, and I am sure she must have taken him for me. Well, said I, as he went out, don't you dare dream now of anything, do you understand? He laughed. And how are you going to account for the money to your father now? I felt like throwing myself into the water, I must own, instead of going home, but I thought, what did anything matter after all? And I went home in desperation like a damned soul. Ugh! Ugh! The petty official wriggled. He positively shuddered. And you know the deceased gentleman was ready to do for a man for 10 rubles, let alone 10,000, he added, nodding to the prince. Mushkin scrutinized Ragozhin with interest. The latter seemed paler than ever at that moment. "'Ready to do for a man?' repeated Ragozhin. "'What do you know about it?' "'He found it all out at once,' he went on, addressing Mushkin. "'And Zolyovshev went gossiping about it to everybody. "'My father took me and locked me up upstairs and was at me for a whole hour. "'This is only a preface,' he said, "'but I'll come in to say good night to you.' "'And what do you think?' "'The old man went to Nastasia Filipovna's, "'bowed down to the ground before her, wept and besought her.' She brought out the box at last and flung it to him. "'Here are your earrings, you old greybeard,' she said, "'and they are 10 times more precious to me now "'since Parfyon faced such a storm to get them for me. "'Greet Parfyon Semyonovich and thank him for me,' she said. "'And meanwhile I'd obtained 20 rubles from Seryozha Protushin "'and with my mother's blessing set off by train to Pskov, "'and I arrived in a fever.' "'The old women began reading the lives of the saints over me, "'and I sat there drunk.' I spent my last farthing in the taverns and lay senseless all night in the street, and my morning I was delirious, and to make matters better, the dogs gnawed me in the night. I had a narrow squeak. "'Well, well, now Nastasia Filipovna will sing another tune,' the official chuckled, rubbing his hands. "'What are earrings now, sir? Now we can make up for it with such earrings. But if you say another word about Nastasia Filipovna, as there is a God above, I'll thrash you!' "'Though you used to go about with the hatch off,' cried Ragozhin, seizing him violently by the arm. "'Well, if you thrash me, you won't turn me away. "'Thrash me? That's just how you'll keep me. "'By thrashing me, you'll have to put your seal on me. "'Oh, why, here we are.' "'They had, in fact, reached the station. "'Though Ragozhin said he had come away in secret, "'several men were waiting for him. "'They shouted and waved their caps to him. "'I say,' "'Zolyovshev here, too,' muttered Ragozhin, gazing at them with a triumphant and almost malicious-looking smile, and he turned suddenly to Mushkin. "'Prince, I don't know why I've taken to you. Perhaps because I've met you at such a moment. Though I've met him, too.' He indicated Lebedev. "'Then I haven't taken to him. "'Come and see me, Prince. We'll take off those gaiters of yours. We'll put you into a first-rate fur coat.' I'll get you a first-class dress coat, a white waistcoat, or what you like. I'll fill your pockets with money. We'll go and see Nastasia Filipovna. Will you come?
Listen, Prince Lvov Nikolaevich,
Lebedev chimed in solemnly and impressively.
Don't miss the charts! Oh, don't miss the charts!
Prince Mushkin stood up, courteously held out his hand to Rogojin, and said cordially,
I will come, with the greatest of pleasure, and thank you very much for liking me. I may come today, even, if I've time, for I tell you frankly, I've taken a great liking to you myself. I liked you particularly when you were telling about the diamond earrings. I liked you before that, too, though you look gloomy. Thank you, too, for the clothes and the fur coat you promised me, for I certainly shall need clothes and a fur coat directly. As for money, I have scarcely a farthing at the moment.
There will be money. There will be money by the evening. Come. There will,
the official assented.
By evening, before sunset, there will be. And women, Prince. Are you very keen on them? Let me know to start with.
No. Perhaps you don't know that, owing to my illness, I know nothing of women.
Well, if that's how it is, cried Rogojin, you are a regular blessed innocent, and God loves such as you. And the Lord God loves such as you, the official repeated. And you, follow me, said Rogojin to Lebedev.
And they all got out of the carriage. Lebedev had ended by gaining his point. The noisy group soon disappeared in the direction of Voznesensky Prospect. The prince had to go towards Litany. It was damp and rainy. Mushkin asked his way of passers-by. It appeared that he had 2 miles to go, and he decided to take a cab.